You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Clemency Burton-Hill. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as the Kurdish PKK releases eight Turkish hostages, tentative hopes are on the rise for an imminent ceasefire. We'll get an update on the ground. And we'll see if Boeing is about to wake up from its dreamliner nightmare.
This is kind of a hiccup on the 787 plan, but clearly Boeing are going to overcome it.
And with the New York Times' second largest shareholder under attack in his own country, we ask, when should newspapers go after their paymasters? And later in the show, our producer Daniel wonders how old geopolitical enemies can become friends with a few magic ingredients.
The glowing status of Great Britain, Germany, and Japan in the American psyche is clearly a testament to the supremely fickle nature of international politics.
All that, plus we'll check in with our man in Belgrade, take a tour of the slow food movement, find out why the Chinese are Swiss obsessed, and we'll play some great tunes too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. One minute past the hour here in London. First, let's catch up on all the headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
In Jordan, the head of the United Nations Refugee Agency High Commissioner, Antonio Guterres, has called for stronger humanitarian assistance and a speedy political solution to the crisis in Syria.
In December, 3,000 a day. In January, 5,000 a day. In February, 8,000 a day, going into neighboring countries. Now, if this goes on like that, in the end of the year, we will have the double or the triple of the number of refugees we have today. And this is something that the host countries and humanitarian agencies will not be able to respond unless they have a much stronger support from the international community.
Meanwhile, Prince Charles and his wife Camilla, the Duchess of Cornwall, have today met Syrian refugees in the Jordanian town of Ramtha, near the border with Syria. The royal couple were greeted by United Nations staff at the King Abdullah Park camp, which is home to just under 1,000 people who fled Syria during the two-year conflict. Prince Charles said he was struck by the generosity of the Jordanian people in the face of a desperate refugee situation.
There's something like 430,000 people here, but they worry terribly that there's going to be 1.23 million people coming in, and apart from the fact, if you think about it, it's the equivalent of the UK having 7 million people descending, or in the United States, 30 million in proportion. So it's a desperate situation, but the Jordanian people are so fantastic because a lot of the refugees already moved into accommodation offered by Jordanian families. And, I mean, the generosity is extraordinary.
Turkish Kurd militants have today freed six Turkish soldiers and two officials they held in the mountains of northern Iraq for more than a year, the first concrete step in efforts to end their 28-year-old insurgency. Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has said that Italy's refusal to send back two of its marines facing a murder trial in India might drastically affect the bilateral relations between the two countries. India summoned the Italian ambassador to protest at Rome's decision not to send the two marines, charged with killing Indian fishermen while on anti-piracy duty, back to India to face trial.
Our government has therefore insisted that the Italian authorities respect the undertakings they have given to the Honourable Supreme Court and return the two accused persons to stand trial in India. If they do not keep their word, there will be consequences for our relations with them.
Hundreds of villagers in Burma have taken to the streets to protest against a controversial copper mine project. The village in question is 475 miles north of the commercial capital Yangon. In its final report to Burma's president, Thein Sein, the investigative committee said the project would benefit the country's economic, social, environmental and international relations. A British member of the European Parliament, Roger Helmer, from the UK Independence Party, has asked the President of the European Parliament, Martin Schulz, today to suspend a working session until an upside-down UK flag outside the building had been set straight.
Mr. President, can I please draw your attention and the attention of the House to the fact that the British national flag outside this Parliament building is hanging upside down? Can I ask you on behalf of the Parliament to apologise to the British people for this insult to their flag? And can I ask you to suspend this sitting until the matter is rectified, please?
And finally, a study has today shown that cockatoos can delay eating nuts in order to win tastier ones, a surprise sign that birds can exercise self-control, a trait usually seen as the preserve of animals with larger brains. Scientists gave goffin cockatoos, a mainly white species from Indonesia, a nut while showing them a more attractive one just out of reach. If the birds didn't nibble the first nut for up to 80 seconds, they learnt they would get the better one, the second one, instead. And that's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Jonathan Wheatley. No need to delay gratification. Here we are on Midori House, where it's 6 minutes past the hour.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Well, I have just heard on reliable information we have white smoke above the Vatican, apparently. We will be obviously bringing you updates from that situation with the new Pope being elected as and when we have them. But meanwhile, at, say, 1807 here in London, 2007 in Istanbul, let's turn our attention to Turkey. Their conflict with the Kurdish PKK has killed over 35,000 people in the past 29 years and is often seen as the country's most pressing historical problem, the issue holding Turkey back, if you like. Now, hopes that a ceasefire may be in place by the Kurdish New Year on March the 21st have been given a boost, as today the PKK released 8 Turkish hostages, including members of the police and military. The release had been called for by the long-jailed PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan, who's recently been in direct talks with the Turkish government, but who remains about as divisive and controversial a figure as they come. So, what does this mean for him and for the future of the peace process in Turkey? To tell us more, we're joined now by Monocle's Istanbul contributor, Caleb Lauer. Thanks, Caleb, for joining us. Good evening.
How are you?
Great, thank you. Big news then in, northern Iraq, where those hostages were released today. Give us the context to this situation.
Well, yeah, as you said, the 8 hostages were released, and they've been held by the PKK for about 2 years. And as you said, these are soldiers and a police officer and also a public official. The context is Öcalan, as part of the peace process that is underway, had called for this show of goodwill, if you will, that these hostages be released. He, in a statement that he made to members of the political party that represents the PKK in the Turkish parliament, he said that both sides, i.e. the Turkish government, the Turkish state, and the PKK, had hostages, and that he would hope that the hostages would soon see their families again. And that came to pass today when the 8 were released. The PKK still holds some hostages.
Tell us more about the figure of Öcalan, because he's got kind of Mandela-like status amongst the PKK, is that right?
Yeah, amongst Kurds, many Kurds, there's about, it's debatable, but let's say 15 million Kurds in Turkey. He is seen by a large majority of them as their leader, the one whose uprising, whose PKK organization has fought for their right, for their rights and for their recognition as a nation within Turkey. He is revered by millions of people. On the other side of the divide, millions of Turks see him as a monster. For years, he was the face of the terrorist group that was killing their sons. And in Turkey, military services is compulsory, which means that many of the dead soldiers were, in fact, conscripts, were not professional soldiers. Mm. And this, of course, is an extremely emotional issue for many, many Turks who have lost so many soldiers. So the figure of Öcalan today, the ironic thing is that he is being used by the Turkish government to achieve peace. He is basically working for the Turkish government towards this peace process, despite the fact that he is the leader of the PKK. The irony is that he is the one that will help the Turkish government achieve peace, but for many Turks, he is a reviled figure.
And indeed, in the international community, of course, the PKK is still viewed as a terrorist organization by the likes of the US. He began these secret talks with the Turkish government last October, I believe. How significant are those talks? I mean, what are we likely to see happen over the coming weeks?
Well, the results of those talks are unprecedented. Of course, Öcalan has been in a Turkish prison for 14 years, which means that he has had many, many contacts with the Turkish state. The Turkish intelligence services have met with him repeatedly. But what's significant this time is that the talks are actually leading to something Turkey has never seen before. And it's not just the peace process itself, although that is the most significant thing. You are seeing the Turkish state speaking with representatives of the PKK as if they are statesmen, stateswomen, representatives of a legitimate national movement. Whereas before, as recent as 4 or 5 months ago, it was still a terrorist organization with which Turkey would never negotiate, so went the rhetoric. But now you see the Turkish government negotiating with people on a one-to-one basis, treating this organization, the PKK, as something legitimate, which is completely unexpected.
Well, and as a model, indeed, that could have wide ramifications throughout the rest of the world and other conflicts too. How is that being received in Turkey itself?
Well, there's two sides to it. One is that this conflict, this insurgency, has gone on so long. The insurgency started in 1984. The PKK was founded in 1978, but the first sort of armed action was 1984. So that's 30 years almost, or is that 30 years? Yeah, 30 years, yeah. 28 years that this thing has been going on, which means that people are very, very tired of this conflict. They have been losing people. 40,000 people have died, more if you talk to human rights activists who are counting the people who have been lost, disappeared, murdered without any sort of record. And so people are just tired of this fight. So the prospect of peace is very, very exciting, except for the fact that the figure of Öcalan and the PKK still are regarded as the enemy by many, many Turks. So on one hand, it's optimism, it's unprecedented optimism, but at the same time, it's very, very cautious, very, very cynical, because this is peace with people that Turks have been long accustomed to not believing peace is possible with.
Fascinating dynamic in that country. We will keep watching with interest. Caleb, thank you so much for joining us. Caleb Lauer, Monocle's contributor in Istanbul. Coming up, we'll get an update on Boeing and its troubled Dreamliner, and we'll ask if and when newspapers should ever go after their paymasters. Stay tuned.
Berlin has long been a magnet for artists. As the city continues to evolve, Monocle Films explores how galleries and artists are being influenced by Berlin's complex presence.
One of the reasons that I'm in Berlin, and which is intriguing for me, is that the history is here. It's not necessarily in these bricks and mortar. It's somehow in this atmosphere. One of the great things with Berlin is it takes time to do things. Berlin is slow enough for art to happen.
Art in Berlin, a film about ghosts of the past with a view to the future, on monocle.com.
. 1814 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. We'll have more on that breaking news from the Vatican City. We'll be crossing over there very shortly. But first, having been grounded for over 6 weeks, there may finally be a little bit of hope in sight for Boeing's 787 Dreamliner. The Federal Aviation Administration today announced that it's approved Boeing's certification plan for the troubled battery system aboard the aircraft. The FAA will also allow flight testing, because the Dreamliner has to pass a series of those before it can return to service. So how near or how far far away is the return to service of the Dreamliner, and how significant is this new approval for Boeing? To tell us more, Rob Morris, senior aviation analyst at Ascend, was joined by our very own Rob Bound, who wanted to know if Boeing will breathe a sigh of relief at this news.
Well, I guess they would. I mean, it is only the first step on the path, though. And of course, now they have the plan with the FAA, it's been approved. They need to now start their flight test activities and demonstrate to the FAA that their plan is compliant with the FAA's requirements. So whilst it's the first step, I think it does still leave us with no real clarity on when the aircraft will return to service.
And is this a significant sort of step? I mean, obviously the problem was broken down to the batteries themselves, and it's sort of therefore easy to blame that element of it. But I guess it has to gel in with the rest of the aircraft. This seems like it's something that will take longer than maybe a month, right?
Well, it's hard to say, to be honest, because they haven't actually published the plan itself. They'll start the flight plans. I mean, Boeing have already spoken a little bit about the potential fix, but, you know, we don't actually know what that's going to be. I think they'll probably now start to brief us more as they start the flight test program and start to pass all those tests they have to get through. Of course, for the airlines, it's still a problem, though, because they don't really know yet when the aircraft can be returned to service. There are 50 aircraft grounded with 8 airlines. Most of those airlines are scheduling, have removed the aircraft from the schedule from sort of May to September time. So there may still be some time to go before the 787 is back in service, I think.
And we talked about these tests, Rob. What are the tests like? We called them stringent as well. What kind of things can they do?
Well, they're talking about redesigning, I think. I mean, effectively, the issue was a short circuit within the battery. So they're talking about improvements that will minimise initiations of short circuits. They're talking about better insulation, and they're talking about addition of new containment and venting systems. And clearly, the plan they presented to the FAA, if they pass those tests, will make the aircraft sort of compliant to the FAA approvals, which are, as we say, very stringent because they're based around safety of flight.
And finally, Rob, Ray Conner, Boeing's commercial chief, came out last week and said that they were going to continue using these lithium-ion batteries, which obviously overheated, which was the problem in the first place. What's the politics of this? I wonder what people in the aviation press are talking about in terms of the PR that Ray Conner's put out with that.
Well, I mean, lithium-ion are used on some other aircraft as well, some corporate jet aircraft, and there are no issues there. So I'm not sure there are any politics. I mean, Boeing selected the battery. They were content that the battery was safe, and with reduced weight, it plays into the and increased power, it plays into the whole operating economics of the aeroplane. So, you know, this is kind of a hiccup on the 787 plan, but clearly Boeing are going to overcome it, and I'm not sure there are any politics really within it.
That was Rob Morris, senior aviation analyst at Ascend, talking to our very own Rob Bound. Here in London, 1918 in Rome. It's white smoke. The bells in St. Peter's Basilica are ringing, and we are crossing over there now to our Monocle contributor, Daniela Peled, who has been there for the last few days watching as we wait, the world awaits to hear news on the new Pope. Daniela, good evening.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. It must be an extraordinary atmosphere over there. Tell us more.
It's very, very, very exciting. I'm standing outside in the rain near the Vatican. We just heard the bells ringing out, deafening volume all over this little part of Rome. You hear them across Rome. They've been really, really deafening here. And everyone is in a fever of excitement. It's white smoke.
Now, we don't know yet who it is. Is that right?
We don't know. We won't know yet for about another hour.
Right.
And pilgrims have been gathering all day in St. Peter's Square. People from all around the world. It's terrible, terrible, terrible rain here, but people have been braving that under their umbrellas, more flocking there all day. The atmosphere has been building and building and building, and now there's an absolute fever pitch of excitement.
I have seen an extraordinary picture on the Guardian website here, a Getty image of everyone crowding under their umbrellas with the lights in St. Peter's Square. It seems incredibly atmospheric and evocative. Is there a sense that, have you been talking to people out there? How are people feeling? Are they excited about what's happening?
They're terribly incredibly excited. I mean, there's some people have just happened to be here on holidays and pilgrimages, been planned for a long time. And ordinarily, you'd think they would be a bit upset since they come to Rome, one of the worst weeks of weather imaginable. But everyone is incredibly excited. I think part of a really diverse array of candidates, and no one knows, obviously, who it is, but I think people are excited about the itself. You know, who will be there to be here at this time if you're a devout Catholic is an immense privilege.
Yeah. Tell us exactly what's going to happen next, over the next hour, before we hear the new name.
Well, the new Pope is being taken. He's been dressed in his new garments. Famously, there are three different sets of vestments, depending on... You can hear people like ringing their bells in the background. Excitement. He'll be revealed to the crowds and take people to square, but not for another little while. Though, so the guessing will continue for a few minutes longer.
Give us an update on that seagull. Anyone who was watching it earlier on this afternoon will have seen that very stubborn gull just sitting there on the chimney as all eyes of the world were waiting to see the white smoke. Any news, any sighting of the seagull now?
No update on that, no. I don't say anything to you on that, right.
Well, we will be, I'm sure, hopefully checking back in with you very soon to hear any further news. Daniela, thank you so much for joining us. It's an extraordinary atmosphere, clearly even just coming down the phone line there. So thanks very much for joining us and enjoy the next hour.
From London.
To New York.
To Tokyo.
To Shanghai.
To Buenos Aires.
To Hong Kong.
To Berlin.
To Tel Aviv.
To Toronto.
To Amsterdam.
To Zurich.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
21 minutes past 6 in the evening here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill. Well, all the news that's fit to print, except perhaps when that news might pertain to your second largest shareholder and lender of last resort. As Mexico's new president, Enrique Peña Nieto, announces a proposal to bust monopolies in his country, eyebrows are being raised as to how the New York Times reports, or doesn't report, on their shareholder Carlos Slim's activities. Well, joining us now is Gavin McFadyen, director of the Centre for Investigative Journalism. Good evening, Gavin. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good evening.
How do you feel about how the New York Times should or shouldn't be exposing Carlos Slim?
It was a question that many of us as journalists asked our colleagues on the New York Times, and we were given a sort of a damp shrug and people saying, what are you kidding? You're gonna attack that hand that feeds you, was the sort of thought. But when I think about this, indeed, there have been so many cases of this in so much of the world's press that you could hardly get it all in 5 or 10 minutes. I mean, Lord Rothermere, a major British publisher, in the interwar period, was a Nazi and Mussolini sympathizer, and yet nobody published any of that in their own papers. We have right now in the Express in London a publisher of whom is an admitted pornographer. Mm. The owner of the Independent is a former secret policeman and an oligarch. I mean, I think nobody in those papers is printing any of that.
Is it just indicative, though, of the woeful state of the print, of the newspaper print industry today, though, that the desperation to have paymasters prop them up means that this will only continue?
I think that's right. But it's not just the print. It's also on television. The famous case in 60 Minutes, which was documented in the film The Insider, about how the CBS executive stopped the transmission of a major film about cancer and tobacco, because one of the shareholders of the company had money in the tobacco industry.
So what's the answer, Gavin? I mean, how are these publications...
independent press. I think, you know, like yours, like Monocle, like The Guardian, these are not beholden to huge commercial interests. And I think you find a real problem when major figures like Carlos Slim, for example, in the New York Times, that was never mentioned as a potential criminal. He was never identified in any way with the scandal of the previous president, which involved the deaths of a number of relatives. And what is connection, if any, to the drug monopolists who control the border with the United States? None of that's ever mentioned.
Was the New York Times wrong, do you think, to allow Slim to step in and to buy that amount of shares and to prop up the Times when it was in its worst, one of its darkest times?
Publisher and an editor in a very difficult place, because you want to publish the truth, you're obliged to tell the public, from a public interest point of view, what's going on. But if you can't say critical things because there's a hugely powerful figure or figures on your board, then you are compromised to begin with.
Yeah.
I mean, the New York Times has been in this position many times, and in the past, not just Carlos Slim. I mean, there were lots of cases where there were grievous misjudgments. For example, during the war in Vietnam, when the New York Times was one of the greatest trumpet players for the war and had to apologize publicly in a front page mea culpa a little later. But that didn't prevent them from doing it at the time and beating the drums for war, which resulted in hundreds of thousands of dead people.
Do you think this has a particularly bitter taste? It leaves a bitter taste in the mouth for, well, not just Times readers, but anyone who cares about the future of an independent press, because it's the New York Times, who spend a lot of time in their editorials and in their journalism, persistently fighting for the poor and the downtrodden, you know, and exposing other rapacious leaders, other rapacious figures elsewhere in the world. Does it feel particularly compromising and difficult in a way, say, that the Daily Express readers might not expect that kind of level of journalistic integrity and rigor?
Well, I think they also don't expect the level of pontification. But you're absolutely right. The New York Times, that's a very bitter pill for them to swallow, that the standards which they hold other newspapers to quite vigorously, they couldn't enjoy themselves. And I think that's a real problem. I mean, for example, we have it here in Britain, similar cases, where, for example, if the New York Times has 10 people covering the ordinary working people of a country, there's not a single person in Britain in any newspaper that's covering labor issues, industrial disputes, and things which used to be the traditional fodder of almost all British papers. And yet nobody says anything about it.
We've managed to get this far in the conversation without mentioning Rupert Murdoch, of course. For any British reader or consumer of the press, he looms so large over our newspapers and indeed television programmes. And I remember when the first scandal was breaking about phone hacking and all of that, some of Murdoch's properties were slow to report on it. There was criticism about that. But in the end, of course, they had to. Do you think that it's ultimately unsustainable for the Times, the New York Times, not to report on Carlos Slim's activities, particularly if this proposal to bust the monopolies in Mexico go ahead?
Well, I think that the proposals to bust the monopolies are every presidential election. I'd be surprised if anything of substantial happens. But having said that, I think that now that he's out and his money is out and he's no longer a figure in New York high society, which was part of his reason for acquiring shares in the Times, that's over. I think they probably will attack him. I mean, after all, if you think that they were the ones who wouldn't print the material from Bradley Manning, they did print it when it came from WikiLeaks, and then they spent a year and a half denouncing WikiLeaks.
Mm.
So I think once he's out, which he now is, then I think they'll spend a lot of time and kick him. It doesn't cost them much. I mean, they'll say a mea culpa, you know, we didn't realize all that, et cetera, all of which is patently untrue, but that'll fly.
Kevin McFadyen, we're going to have to leave it there, sadly, but this question, I'm sure, will continue to keep us up at night, and hopefully the New York Times editors too. Director of Centre for Investigative Journalism, thanks so much for joining us here on Midori House. It's coming up to 1:30 the hour, time for a quick song, and indeed from Mexico, this is Vidas Paralelas. That was Ximena Sariñana with Vidas Paralelas. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll check in with our man in Belgrade, we'll ask why the Chinese are going gaga over Switzerland, and we'll gently ponder the future of the slow food movement. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. A new pope has been chosen at the Sistine Chapel by over two-thirds of the 115 cardinals. White smoke appeared just minutes ago with the bells of St Peter's Basilica ringing. Now a candidate has been chosen. The cardinal dean will ask him if he's willing to accept and what his papal name will be, and then the new pope will be brought out to greet the crowd in St Peter's Square. Other news now. Prince Philip, Prince Charles and his wife Camilla, the Duchess of Cornwall, have today met Syrian refugees in the Jordanian town of Ramtha near the border with Syria. The royal couple were greeted by UN staff at the King Abdullah Park camp, which is home to just under 1,000 people who fled Syria during the two-year-old conflict. Turkish Kurd militants have today freed six Turkish soldiers and two officials they'd held in the mountains of northern Iraq for more than a year, the first concrete step in efforts to end their 28-year-old insurgency. And the Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has said that Italy's refusal to send back two of its marines facing a murder trial in India might drastically affect the bilateral relations between the two countries. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Jonathan Wheatley. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, where it's 33 minutes past six in the evening in London, 33 minutes past seven in Belgrade, and time to check in now with one of our correspondents around the globe. Today we are talking assassinations, art, football and diplomacy. And for that, we're joined by Monocle's man in Belgrade, Guy Delaunay. Good morning, good evening, Guy.
Good evening. Sounds like a really good mix, the way you put it, Clemency.
Well, it is a good mix, isn't it? Assassinations, art, football and diplomacy. I mean, that's certainly going to keep everyone interested for a while.
We were also trying to get a link with the Pope. And what I can tell you is this, that 1700 years ago, this year, Emperor Constantine of Rome gave the Christians freedom of worship. And he was born in Serbia, in Niš, in Serbia. So there's the link.
There you go. There is the link. Smoothly done. We like it. Let's start with a slightly less happy story, though. And let's start with assassinations and indeed a 10th anniversary of a rather significant one. Tell us more.
That's right. Former Prime Minister of Serbia, Zoran Djindjic, who was the first democratically elected Prime Minister of Serbia, who took office in 2001, was assassinated 10 years ago. It was actually yesterday would mark the anniversary, but the commemorations are still going on over the next week or so. But
how is he commemorated?
Well, tens of thousands of people turned out to march, first of all, to the site of his assassination, which was just yards from the Prime Minister's office in Belgrade. And then they went on to the cemetery where he's buried and paid their respects at his grave. And, you know, it's quite an extraordinary thing that 10 years later, after things moved very quickly in the world, that he's still thought of at such a level.
He played, of course, such a pivotal role in the arrest and extradition of Milosevic to The Hague to face war crimes charges. Is there anyone else who can fill that gap?
Well, that's been the thing. A lot of people were saying yesterday that when he was shot, that the progress in Serbia all came to an end. Now, he was shot by a police unit, which was still sympathetic to President Milosevic. And so he really paid for those reforms with his life. And he was trying to do other things as well. He was trying to point Serbia towards the European Union, membership of that, trying to institute economic reforms after all the years of state socialism that had been in Serbia, and then later on some very dubious privatizations. He was trying to make it a modern, democratic, Europe-facing country. Mm. And his success, as though they were in the same party as him, the Democratic Party, simply didn't have that level of vision, expertise or integrity to get that going again.
Apart from the commemoration, apart from the marches and the red roses, are there other ways in which his legacy lives on?
Well, he's starting to see it now. I think the fact that he is respected so much, that he's become arguably the most venerated figure in Serbia's modern history, that he's respected by members of all parties. I think that's a very significant legacy indeed. You saw members of the current administration laying wreaths at the spot where he was killed yesterday. That's the first time that members of the opposition, what were the opposition parties to the Democrats, have done so. Now they're in government since last July, and we've seen them adopting a lot of Djindjic's policies and pushing them forward, ironically, in a way in which the Democrats themselves had never been able to do. So we've got this real push now for European Union membership, an anti-corruption program which is going down very well with the electorate. And these policies which Djindjic was trying to push 10 years ago do now finally seem to be coming to fruition.
Fascinating. Well, let's move on, as we've promised everyone, to art. And quite significant, extraordinary, in fact, a painting by Rembrandt has been recovered. It was stolen 7 years ago and it's turned up in Serbia. Tell us more.
That's correct. It was stolen from a museum in Novi Sad, which is in effect Serbia's second city. This is 7 years ago, and there was an armed robbery at the time. Masked armed robbers tied up the security guards and made off with their four paintings. Well, one of those has now been found. It's a Rembrandt valued at around $4 million, if you please. This is a portrait of a father, and it has now been recovered, only about 60 kilometres down the road from the place where it was originally stolen. So whoever stole it possibly found it was a bit of too hot to handle.
Are art thefts big news in Serbia?
Well, I think Serbian gangs do have a very bad reputation when it comes to art theft. You'll have seen that last year in Serbia, a Cezanne turned up here that had originally been stolen from a museum in Switzerland, and it turned up in Belgrade and had clearly been involvement by Serbian criminals. And this particular painting was valued at more than $100 million. And if you read up on these sort of things, you'll see that the people who track down stolen artworks often are saying that Eastern European gangs, and particularly Serbian gangs, often have a hand in these thefts.
Well, Serbian gangs also sadly have a rather bad reputation when it comes to football hooliganism. Tell us what UEFA's been warning them about.
UEFA's been warning both Serbia and Croatia that they're at risk of being banned from international competition if they don't crack down on violence among football fans, and of course racism, which is something that we saw a few months ago in a match between Serbia and England under-21s here in Serbia. Interestingly, though, Michel Platini, the head of UEFA, the European sports governing body, has written to the prime ministers of both countries, which some are taking as a bit undiplomatic of him, saying it's not the place of Michel Platini to engage in this sort of correspondence with prime ministers. The Croatians in particular have taken great umbrage at this, and they've said that it's inappropriate for Platini to write in this way. Serbia, on the other hand, has made some commitments that it will try and tackle these issues, and it's extremely apposite because next week Croatia and Serbia will play each other for the first time ever in international competition.
Well, in that World Cup qualifier, hopefully they'll keep the peace. Hopefully if it takes the Prime Minister stepping in to do that, then so be it. Let's talk very quickly now about diplomacy. Cathy Ashton, the EU Foreign Affairs Minister, is going to meet Serb President any minute now, on next week. So tell us more about that and what she might have to achieve.
Cathy Ashton's involved in a bit of shuttle diplomacy. She's planning, although whether this comes off or not is another thing, still a bit up in the air, as is she. She's going to be in Pristina in Kosovo and probably in Belgrade as well tomorrow, trying to knock some heads together, because we seem to be very close to a settlement between Serbia and Kosovo on what's going to happen to the Serb communities in the north of Kosovo. And this may lead to some kind of normalisation of relations, but it's all very tense and nothing's settled at all at the moment.
It would be hugely significant, would it not, if Belgrade were to come to a little bit closer to recognising Pristina's independence?
And it would be an enormous step forward to them joining the European Union. And this is what's driving the dialogue at the moment. And again, the irony is, these are former Milosevic supporters who are in government now, and they're the ones who've actually really taken the bit between the teeth and driving forward.
Just remind us, in terms of the EU's 27 member states, who else amongst them recognises Pristina's independence?
Well, most of them do, but there's a few significant ones. Notably, you've got Spain, obviously, doesn't recognise Kosovo's independence because they've got separatist problems of their own. Yeah. I think if you've got a country that's got a separatist problem, they're not going to recognise Kosovo.
We're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much, Guy Delaunay. Fantastic to talk to you, as always, our man in Belgrade. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back with some music after this.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the global pulse.
I was at a Bunga Bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. The guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them and we know that he'd used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
and some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
Here in Midori House. You're listening to me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and we've got a song now. This is Arlette Zola with Je suis folle de tant t'aimer. That was Je suis folle de tant aimer by Arlette Zola, who's from Switzerland. 1844 here in London, 1944 in Switzerland, and it's been over a decade since that country opened a national tourism office in China, well ahead of other European nations. And that pioneering move certainly seems like a wise one now. China's recent economic boom has seen a sharp rise in international travel amongst wealthy Chinese, and guess where they all want to go? Well, joining us now to tell us more about the Chinese love affair with all things Swiss is Marianne Fassbind, business editor of Schweizer Fernsehen TV. Good evening, Marianne.
Hello.
Thank you very much for joining us. So the Swiss were the first ones in. They got their national tourism office in their early days, and that certainly seems to have paid off. Tell us more.
Yes, it pays a lot because the visitors of China increased in the last few years. They doubled exponentially, and it was worth to go to China to try the Chinese come to Switzerland.
It seems extraordinary that more tourists are coming to Switzerland from China than from much closer destinations such as Italy or the Netherlands. What are they after in Switzerland? What do you think it is about Switzerland that's so appealing to them?
Well, I don't think they only come to Switzerland. They always do a tour in Europe, and they start in Germany. They are going to different places in Germany, and then they come to Switzerland, of course. Then they want to see the mountains, the snow, and buy the watches. And then they continue to Paris and to Italy, of course. I don't think they are only only comes to Switzerland, but they stay more day in Switzerland than in other countries.
The wealthy Chinese traveller, of course, is desperately wanted now by every single economy, every single market. How does Switzerland approach them? What can Switzerland do to keep Chinese travellers there, to keep tourists there, and to keep them coming back and staying longer?
Well, first of all, what I have to mention, Switzerland was at the sixth exhibition in China. The Swiss was there. Switzerland was there with cable cars and so on. And there it was worth to bring near the Swiss tourism. And I think also they just want to have the atmosphere of Switzerland and also the service in the hotels and restaurants. They like it very much.
And so
they don't want to see just one mountain. They are visiting two mountains or different regions in Switzerland.
Who can blame them? Certainly those amenities would appeal to all of us. How easy is it for Chinese travellers to get to Switzerland? Are there direct flights?
Yes, there are direct flights to Switzerland, but I really think they are doing this in a Europe tour. They make Europe in 10 days, and Switzerland belongs to the Europe tour.
And just tell me how many people in Switzerland speak Mandarin or Cantonese. Is there much of a language barrier?
No, there are not many people who are speaking Mandarin. But what's the funny thing, in the jewelry stores and also in the mountain, they have now people from China, they speak Chinese. And the Chinese people, they want that they have fellow men or fellow women which are speaking Chinese. And also the people which are coming from China, they are expats, they are married with a Swiss guy or a Swiss woman, and they just stay here and they are happy to find the good work at the mountain or in hotels or in restaurants.
Very interesting new trends in tourism. Thank you so much, Marianne Fassbind, business editor of Schweizer Fernsehen TV, for your insights there. We'll be right back. 1849 here in Midori House with me, Clemency Burton-Hill. Today, members of the EU Parliament meet in Strasbourg to vote on reform proposals to the Common Agricultural Policy, the thread that ties Europe's farmers with its half-billion consumers. More than 300 amendments are on the table. The issues involved range from crop rotations to small farms, and they're particularly important to Slow Food, an international grassroots organisation focused on the links between good food, local communities and the environment. Well, joining me now on Monocle 24 is Paolo Di Croce, International Secretary of the Slow Food International Board of Directors, the highest governing body of Slow Food International. Good evening, Paolo.
Good evening.
Thank you very much for joining us here on Monocle. Certainly, we're all fascinated by this movement and how it's gained so much traction in recent years. Tell us more about those 300 amendments that the EU Parliament's been debating today and what this is likely to mean for the slow food movement.
I think that it means a lot to our movement, and I think that it means a lot for every single person living in Europe and also living on this planet, because, sometimes it's very difficult to connect all these amendments and also the cap that we don't know. But it talks about agriculture, it talks about food. Every single person in Europe, if he is lucky, has to eat at least twice a day. So it's really something that touches us, and also the amount of money that is involved in the cap reform, it's huge. So it's really something that is very important. And it's really something that is so important, especially in this historical period for Europe, and not only for Europe. We don't have to forget that we are living in a very difficult period, very difficult problems, and we live in Europe where 500 million people in Europe, 250 are overweight or obese, and 42 million live in condition of serious privation related to. To the food, they don't have access to food. So it's so important. And, 350 amendments, and it's so important to think about few things, about just one example above everything else, the greening, the necessity to have a common agricultural policy that can support the value of the commons, the environment, the protection of the non-renewable resources, such as groundwater, soil fertility. So it's really the time to make a change to make the agricultural policy more sustainable.
And is there much consensus, or are there really differing attitudes between the 27 member states of the EU?
There are a lot of discussion, a lot of diversities. Of course, Europe, there are always different opinions related from one country to another, and in this case there are also many different opinions between the Commission, where the Commissioner Dalton Santolos tried to put forward a lot of new things that on one end Slow Food and other organizations all over Europe are really supporting, like the greening, like for example some measures on helping and trying to facilitating the involvement of the youth in agriculture. We don't have to forget that in this period of the worst financial crisis in the last 60 years, where unemployment is such a big issue in all our Europe, we are losing jobs in agriculture. Mm. Young people, they are not willing to work in agriculture, so it's very important to focus on these things. And I really hope that the member states and that in the next discussion that they will start from tomorrow between the Commission, the Parliament, and the member states, we will really sort out with something more sustainable, thinking to the youth, thinking to the food of our future.
Paolo, amongst all those very many pressing issues facing this topic, what do you think the single most important thing is, and what would you most like to see come out of the next few days?
For sure, a big attention on the greening. For sure, we think that it's not only wrong, it's immoral to use public money and to give public money to farmers and to agriculture, a kind of agriculture that can pollute and can impoverish, can create problems to the earth, our mother earth. So this is very important, and for us, we really hope that something can happen to improve this aspect. And there is another aspect that is so important for us. That is the attention to paying more attention to the small-scale farmers. Small-scale farming can be represent a very good alternative for employment, as I said before. Very often they are more sustainable environmentally. Very often they can preserve our local identity, the different local biodiversities. And in the last years, too often the agricultural policies were more supportive towards the big scale, towards the agro-industry, the agro-business, and not paying enough attention to the small scale. So we really think that it would be so important to try to shift this and to pay more attention to the small-scale, sustainable farmers.
Well, let's hope that the EU come to some agreement on all of that, because it certainly seems, as you say, absolutely unavoidable and important as an issue. Thank you so much, Paolo Di Croce, International Secretary of the Slow Food International Board of Directors. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. '55 here in London. Still no news on the new Pope, other than that he has been elected, but we're still waiting. We will bring you that news as and when it comes. But meanwhile, time for our daily monologue. And today we turn to Monocle's superstar producer, Daniel Giacopelli, who looks at a recent poll of Americans' perceptions of other countries and wonders which current enemies may one day become friends.
One put a torch to the White House and burned it down. Another killed hundreds of thousands of American soldiers on battlefields across Europe. The third was responsible for the deadliest attack on American soil in history, until 9/11. Yet to the imagined horror of the revolutionary Yank, the paratrooper over Normandy, and the bloodied officer on Oahu, all three of the above countries ranked at the very top of a new list of Americans' most favorable nations in 2013. The veteran polling firm Gallup was responsible for this curious look at how Americans view the world. The glowing status of Great Britain, Germany, and Japan in the American psyche is clearly a testament to the supremely fickle nature of international politics. Sworn enemies can indeed become the best of friends given enough money, mutual interests, handshakes, and smiles. And, of course, time. But dig a bit deeper and some surprising details jump out. And others are counterintuitive. For one, we seem to be a curiously negative bunch when peering out at the world, despite our personal friendliness. A friendliness that many of my European friends view with deep cynicism and a smirk. But I swear it's mostly genuine. So why do we give 15 out of the listed 22 countries a more unfavorable than favorable rating? And how are these perceptions shaped? I think of this when looking at Cuba. 34% of Americans now look at the Castro brothers' island with positivity, despite half a century of tensions and embargoes and diplomatic bluster. Will Iran, sitting sadly at least favorable on the list, one day rise up in similar fashion as nuclear fears pass and the mullahs, maybe, mellow out? And here's something. Despite Cuba's rising favorability, Americans still view that country more negatively than the cyber-spying powerhouse in the East, China, the country most likely to overtake America's status as world superpower. It's a humorous mark of a Cold War mentality. Two final things. More Americans lack an opinion of Venezuela than any other country. Surely Chavez mania will push this number in one direction, but which way will it go? And I read that a mysterious U.S.-based organization sent the Hermit Kingdom's current leader a congratulatory letter after its recent nuclear bomb test. Maybe they have a secret lobbying campaign. 3% of Americans view the North in a positively glowing light. I'd really like to meet them. For Monocle, I'm Daniel Giacopelli.
Well, on that note, sadly, that's all we have time for today. Thanks very much to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexa Firmanich, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Next up is The Entrepreneurs, where we'll be speaking to the head of Rolls-Royce about how the classic car company is driving towards a new and younger market.
You need to maintain that myth of Rolls-Royce is the best, is something used even as a synonym for the best, the Rolls-Royce of kitchens or whatever. And you need to transport that message constantly, also into younger brains.
At 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson will be back for the Monocle Daily. I will be back bright and early in the morning with The Globalist, and Dominic Reynolds will be here with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. From me, Clemency Burton-Hill, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.